Thanks to our sponsor, GoWell Consulting. GoWell Consulting is guiding businesses to the sustainable future. Go to gowellconsulting.co.nz to find an expert that will help your business navigate the journey.
Hey, and welcome to How to Save the World podcast. And today we've got a special treat. We've got Dr. Mike Joy, who's an award-winning senior researcher at the Institute for Governance and Policy. Deep breath, at Wellington's Victoria University. So, hey Mike, welcome.
Hi.
And your specialty is freshwater ecology.
Yeah, that's been my specialty. I mean, I've been teaching environmental science for a couple of decades as well at university, and I'm seeing the bigger picture and branching out. But, you know, that's the core of my research. Yeah.
That was your PhD thesis,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right,
coming
it was.
Coming up with new ways to measure.
Yep. Yeah, using bioassessment, we call it. So using the things that live in freshwater as a way of measuring the health of them rather than these kind of random things that we pick on to measure that are pretty meaningless.
Yeah. Well, there is... So I've only... I'm very new to this whole world.
Mm-hmm. And
but when Waveney said that she had booked you on the show, I was very delighted, and then quickly went and did a lot of research, and it seems like there's a million things we could talk to you about today because you've just got such a breadth of sort of a huge career and professional body of work and all these sorts of related areas. But the waterways is what we wanted to start with, because not only been working in this area, but quite bravely and fearlessly, and you've gone up against when governments have been talking BS and calling them out.
This is what I love about you, Mike. Is this you're a scientist and a communicator.
Yeah.
I think you're one of New Zealand's most visible, vocal communicators, and you've got the science behind you.
Yeah, but it's mostly anger driven. And so mostly what I'm doing is responding to BS, So government and especially local government and big business talking BS, and I want to get on with work, but then I have to say, hey, hang on a minute, that's not right, you know, you're spinning this whole thing. So that's basically why I'm having that, you know, that role as a university academic. Our job is to be critic and conscience. That's what universities are there for, not to be, you know, what they've turned into, just industry research instruments. They were supposed to be there for the people to balance up that one-sided, you know, industry world. But yeah, we're losing. I mean, under the model at the moment, I was at Massey University, and it was extremely difficult to be at an agricultural university when all your research is showing the impacts of agriculture on the environment.
True.
Waveney and I went through what we wanted to ask you, but just quickly, like, even in New Zealand, how much do you feel that tension in a university environment or just a tertiary environment where the research you're doing goes against the sort of community that the university's a part of?
Yeah, it's tricky. I mean, I was in an ecology group, which was a small part of the Institute of Agriculture. So within my group, it's fine, we're all ecologists, we're all kind of on the same page, but then just across the hallway are all the ag scientists funded by Dairy New Zealand, Fonterra, you name it.
Figuring out how to get better yields from
your dairy figuring out how to industrialise farming, basically.
Yeah, and you're going, oh my God, you're killing the entire country.
We're going totally the wrong way here, boys. And there was tensions when, at one stage, one of the regional, it happened a few times in different forms, but the regional councils saying to these guys, you know, we're funding your research and you know, you better tell that guy to pull his head in, because you know, it's otherwise you're not going to get your funding, kind of thing. So it's having to go at colleagues.
Gee. Happen.
Oh yeah,
even in New Zealand. Gosh.
Oh, for sure.
So
I was so lucky to have Steve Mahari as vice chancellor for most of the time that I was there, because he was fending off a heap of this stuff from Federated Farmers CEO. Used to ring every week. He said he could almost set his clock by it, you know, demanding that I be, you know, sacked.
Ouched.
And you know, get rid of him because he's really annoying us, you know. And journos from rural media, whatever they call themselves, that they're just advertising, but they would say, you know, things
pull no
like
punches, Mike.
No, well, I mean, they expected that a university would have like a corporate statement. They were just, how can an agricultural university have someone saying bad stuff about industrial agriculture? Just, they thought it was like Coca-Cola or something where there was a mission statement and everybody followed it, you know.
Opposed to research.
Yeah, lead. That we're supposed to be, that's the idea, is that we all have different ideas and, you know, do our own thing.
So you've been actually getting hammered is like the easier thing would have been to keep your head down. What's making you so passionate about this? Like, what are the drivers? What's the problem?
I often think about this, and it's some kind of overblown sense of justice, or, you know. So I really hate seeing a small number of people, organisations, or whatever, taking something from everyone else that doesn't belong to them, whether it's polluting rivers or you know, mining things that belong to other people, or commercially fishing away, you know, things that belong to other people. So it's that kind of, you know, sense of injustice that I'm trying to correct all the time, you know.
I think people on the other side of that would see it as someone who's getting in the way, maybe putting making a fish more important than a person and their family that they're trying to support.
Yeah, no, it tends to not be the person and the family. It's the you know, the company and the profit that I'm getting in the way of, you know. And it's always short term. It's like, you know, if we you know, put this mine down, and it's going to make us some money in the short term. In the long term, you know, it's going to cost all of us a huge amount of money. Mm-hmm. But that's always the thing: a job now versus, you know, no future.
So let's talk through the thing that is driving, or that has been driving, this passion and sense of injustice, which is the state of our waterways in New Zealand, which I understand from some of your research is right up there in terms of the most polluted you can find in the world, and which just seems crazy to me in terms of my own non-scientific sense of clean, green New Zealand. There are places I wouldn't swim, but mostly think, oh, surely China would have to be worse, or, yeah.
Well, the trouble is that most of it's not visible. So, I mean, I think nitrate's a really good example like that, of that. We have, you know, in some of our rivers, or most of our rivers that run through intensive agriculture, like the Waikato River and the Manawatu River and, you know, Selwyn River and Canterbury and a whole bunch of others, that where nitrate flux through those rivers is higher than almost any river I can find in the world.
Wow.
Purely as a result of nitrogen fertilizer, which is, you know, like, the story just gets worse and worse, because the nitrate fertilizer is made from fossil fuels. So we make milk out of oil, or gas in our case, a third from New Zealand and two thirds from the Middle East. We grow the grass. A little bit of that nitrate goes out with the milk, but most of it goes out in urine and ends up down in the aquifers and in the rivers and in the lakes and causes the pollution.
How does it do that? Because this is one of the things I've stumbled on when you've been talking about it.
Yeah, no, and I've always, you know, thinking about visibility. If it turned our rivers red, you know, we wouldn't have this problem. It's only because you can't see it. Yeah. And then, well, so there's a whole bunch of effects, but mostly it's, you won't see it until summertime. And when it's, the sun's out and the river flows low, suddenly algae will grow, and it will grow really, really fast. And that nitrate's driving that growth. And then the algae that grows can be big, long, filamentous stuff, or whole thick mats on the bed of the stream. That starts to suck the oxygen out of the water. So you get these big fluctuations from day to night of oxygen levels. For example, in the Manawatu River, where they've got dissolved oxygen meters going constantly, and listeners can even go online and have a look at these things, because they're real-time telemetered onto this internet. And you can see in wintertime they barely move, the oxygen's pretty constant. But then as soon as it's warm and sunny, the algae grows, it starts to swing from 30% to 160%. And most of our stream life can't live in that, so they die.
So the fish need oxygen.
Fish need oxygen, like,
so
all of us.
They're literally suffocating as a result of the nitrate.
So some of them, you know how you'll see your goldfish in a bowl gulp air off the surface?
Yeah.
They're adapted to do that, but most of our native fish in life can't do that, so they'll die from lack of oxygen.
How bad is it? Is it that only a few of the vulnerable species, or is
no,
it?
No, we've got the highest proportion of threatened native freshwater fish in the world. So three quarters of our native fish, of our 50-odd species, are threatened with extinction.
Highest in the world.
Highest that I can find in the world. I'm sure there's undeveloped countries that don't measure it, but of the developed world where this is done, you know.
Three quarters are looking at
it. And that's from 20% in 1993, when we first classified our fish back in the beginning of DOC. That's gone up regularly every time since then to 74% now.
So we've always been farmers, yeah? What's
well,
the...
yeah, no, we have, but then we've never been so intensive. So really the last three decades, we went from fixing, We never had nitrogen fertilizer until early 80s, and then it was only a tiny amount. It really wasn't until the late 90s we started pumping nitrogen fertilizer. So up until then, we fixed nitrogen naturally from clover. Our paddocks were full of clover. They fix nitrogen from the atmosphere to make them grow and supply it, you know, to the system. So, and how it always worked, but it was in the, I don't know, early 1930s or 20s or something like that, that the scientists Haber-Bosch discovered that you could make nitrogen fertilizer out of natural gas, and that started this industrialization of farming and pretty much drove the population growth that happened on the planet for the last, you know, 100 years. Was that suddenly you could feed so many more people because you're growing food from the past, from ancient history.
Yeah, from the sunshine.
From solar energy stored in fossil fuels. Yeah. So suddenly we're eating the past and we're coming. Now we're in trouble. And so this is, and it's really, it's interesting, and I hope this will be the changer that we needed. But it turns out that those high nitrogen levels in the water that we've allowed to happen over this time have a really direct human health impact. So that's what I've been pointing out recently in Canterbury. There's a couple of huge studies from around the world that the data's been gathering, the papers have been gathering over the last 20 years, that nitrate, quite low nitrate levels in drinking water are associated with colorectal cancer. And so we have the highest rates of colorectal cancer in the world in New Zealand. And the highest rates in New Zealand are down in Canterbury. And then you look at the nitrate levels, which I've been doing, and the drinking water down in Canterbury, because you know, it's really, really stony soils. If you've been to the Canterbury Plains, they're just outwashed plains. The paddocks are basically rocks. And you've had massive increase in intensification of farming there. Well, that was actually sheep and cropping. And then you convert it.
There's been research done into establishing a link between the nitrogen levels and increased rates of cancer.
So this is the Danish study that came out this year. Is 23 or 4 years worth of data on 9 million people in Denmark, because they had nitrogen issues like us from intensive farming, but they knocked it on the head a long time ago. But they have that long-term data. Being a rich country, they can collect all that stuff.
Yeah,
massive study, you know, published in a top journal. And what it shows, that 0.87 milligrams of nitrogen per litre is the level where a significant increase in the risk, and then it goes up from there, about 3% risk increase with every milligram. Well, lots of people in Canterbury are drinking water at 2, 3, 4, 5, whoa, 6 milligrams, which is...
And you're saying 0.8 is the...
So that, and that turns out is really coincidental, but that's close to the level where you start to get problems in the streams with algal growth. So the ANZAC, Australia and New Zealand, the Australasian guidelines say that 0.5 milligram is the kind of the trigger point, and anything above that you're at risk of an algal bloom. So it's really interesting and coincidental that turns out to be, you know, about the limit where it starts to become unhealthy for drinking water as well. But you get Canterbury, where everybody's drinking water from groundwater, that's where you start to see the results, you know. So you had, like for the rest of the country, we had dairy farming, but nowhere near at the level. So basically, if you just roughly, in rough figures are, 30 years, we only doubled the number of cows, but we quadrupled the output, the amount of milk solids produced. So what that tells you...
So per cow was doubling the yield of milk.
Per cow doubling, which means that was only achieved by heaps more outside stuff. So heaps more fertilizer, palm kernel, we're the biggest importer in the world of palm kernel.
Is that a feed for the
cow? Yeah, so that comes from the palm oil business, and we're kind of getting the residue that's left from that. That should go back into the Indonesian soils to grow more stuff. But, you know, there's a whole environmental nightmare around palm oil, but we're involved in that. So we import the stuff. And
so if you're just buying a bottle of milk or a block of cheese or a pack of meat, which you wouldn't think had palm oil implicated in it.
It has,
absolutely.
Yeah, totally.
That's for conventional farming, though.
That's for industrial dairy farming, which is the way we do it. I mean, not all dairy farmers, but the vast majority of dairy farmers in New Zealand now, you know, the organic guys, and it's just standard, everyday use to use palm kernel and a heap of nitrogen fertilizer and urea.
But not for the organic guys.
No, the organic guys don't. And you know, there are some, well, you know, we can talk about this, but regenerative farmers, or there's, you know, a whole kind of a whole other world. But most farmers, and this is because it's like this industrial model that's a heavily indebted. So the latest Reserve Bank of New Zealand figures that came out, that 35% of the dairy farmers in New Zealand have more than $35 worth of debt for every kilogram of milk solids they produce. Oh, yeah. So what that translates to, and this is from Reserve Bank of New Zealand, not me, is that they have to get paid between $6.20 and $6.30 a kilo to break even, because most of their money is just going to the debt to those big four Aussie banks. So, and that's about the price they're going to get paid, with Fonterra in trouble and announcing that they're not going to pay a dividend to the farmers. Most farmers will only be getting $6.20, $6.30, which is break even. So they'll be working for nothing on those 35% of the farms.
So in addition to all of the ecological damage this is doing, economically, it doesn't even seem to be making sense anymore.
And it doesn't make any sense. I can give you another example of how it completely doesn't make sense. For two lakes in New Zealand, Lake Taupo and Lake Rotorua, we, local bodies, government, the whole process has decided that they're precious lakes and we don't want to lose them, right? So we, in the case of Lake Taupo, they had a plan change there to really limit the, and so $90 million worth of taxpayers' funds went to pay farmers not to farm animals in those catchments. The same thing's happening with Lake Rotorua. We're underway with it at the moment. $40 million to pay, I don't know how many, maybe 10 or 20 farmers not to farm there.
Whoa.
And what we're
talking about, welfare schemes.
Yeah, exactly. It's corporate welfare. So what we're doing is, you know, like I kind of like it in a way, because it's actually a fence at the top of the cliff rather than an ambulance at the bottom. But we'll pay them $400 for every kilogram of nitrate that they leach,
right?
Which is many, many millions of dollars for each farm. So if we applied that same logic to the rest of our rivers, and I'll give you the example of Canterbury, there's 30 million tons of nitrate lost from, you know, yearly out of dairy farming systems in Canterbury. That's not my data, that's official data. If you multiply that by 400, it comes to $12 billion is what, if we paid the same, if we applied the same logic to Canterbury rivers and lakes as we do to Lake Rotorua and Lake Taupo, then we would be paying them $12 billion to pack up and go.
Yeah.
You know, to have healthy rivers. But, or in other words, we are subsidizing them to the tune of $12 billion to carry on farming.
Yeah, because that's the value to us. Yeah. So if
but
if
we're
we
not
were
we're
to...
not paying it though. This is the thing. You know, so all we're doing is leaving it to our kids. You know, the legacy is just building up in nitrate, building up in rivers, you know. So no one's paying it.
Is this some sort of intractable problem, or are there solutions that you can think of that are actually pretty?
And actually to tack onto that as well, before, because we do want to talk about what's the term, permaculture.
And
that different styles of farming, but before we do, in addition to what Wave just said, how different is organic dairy farming to the traditional intensive farming that we're used to?
It's kind of it's hard to describe. It's a bit better. It's still bad, but it's a bit better. You know, it's less bad, is what I'll say. You know, it's still got lots of problems. Oh, well, it depends. The actual, you know, this is always the trouble: is how do you define something, right? Mm. And so it's like you hear this term regenerative farming or biofarming. It's a bit like tacking eco onto your brand, you know. It doesn't actually mean anything, you know, unless you have some kind of certification system, which is what the organic guys do have.
Yeah.
And it's quite...
And there's the BioGrow.
Yeah, yeah, those sort of things. Yeah. But they... So to meet those things, sometimes bad things are done. You know, so you can say, oh, we're not allowed to use an antibiotic, so we'll use a metal instead. Or, you know, there can be risky downsides to really strongly legislating about how to meet something or not meet it. So organic farming is I'll go as far as to say it's a lot better than the average industrial farmer at the moment. But then there are some non-organic regenerative farmers who are doing just as good a job, you know. So it's and we've just had in the newsroom today, Peter Fraser and I wrote a article where we show, we point out how clearly, we have known this for such a long time, that farmers can make more money by doing less. You know, they make more profit.
Yeah. Tell us about that.
Well, so in this, this is the example we gave was of the Lincoln Dairy Farm. They did it back in 2012, 2013, but there's a heap of other farms that have done it as well, where they cut back by about 15% the number of cows. They increased their profit by 40%. Their per cow production went up from 400 to 500 kgs. So you
cow?
Just
Sorry?
Oh, it's just because it's a farm is a biological system, right? If we had a little business here making, I don't know, clothes pegs, and as long as we had a market, we kept on buying more wood to make wooden clothes pegs, you know, there's this nice linear relationship where we make more and more money. But in a farming system, they're biological. So you put more stuff on, you win up to a point. And then it plateaus,
then
right?
Then you get diminishing returns.
Yeah, diminishing returns. So
but
you spend,
stuck and you have to keep doing
well, yeah,
it
but you are stuck in this case because the bank has invested so much money. You know, you're mortgaged up to your eyeballs. The bank sees every dollar that goes that doesn't go to fertilizer because they don't understand this relationship is potentially a loss for them, you know, or the loss of the land value because there's a big difference between a lot of farming is done for land value, for capital gains, but like Auckland housing market, it's done for the capital gains are there, not the rental income is incidental, it's the capital gain that you're living on. Well, it's very much like that, has been like that for farming in New Zealand as well.
Which in the housing market, and I imagine it's probably the same in farming, is a very bad and disruptive economic sort of paradigm to be working in because it's not actually a productive good that's helping
it's
the country
great.
Or the economy.
It's great just for this, banks.
Yeah, it's an inflated figure on a page until it isn't.
That's right.
And then you get a recession or...
Yep, and I think, you know, we're going to see that. We are seeing that already with Fonterra in trouble, and, you know, that's it's been ridden hard for
it can
a
only last
decades.
So long, right? Because that value is only that value until people decide that the land isn't actually worth that amount if it's not being a productive good where there's a regular output that you can see.
Yeah.
So how, to your mind, I don't know if there's research on this, but how much are we over farming past that plateau point that you're talking about?
Oh, it will totally depend on the farm and where it is. Right. So that Lincoln, that was at the hardest end of the scale because that was at that one of the top tier kind of ranking of farming.
In terms of how intensive it was.
Yeah, yeah. So right. So you know, and every all the systems are perfect kind of thing. And so having a win there is really hard. There's some other ones that are much easier to get wins and you can get much bigger wins than that. And you know, my colleague or friend Alison Dews, who's environment manager for Landcorp, she's worked with a heap of farms in the Waikato and she has, you know, spreadsheets on all of these farms that she's been working with, and you go across and the most profitable farmers have the least impacts. You know, there's a really strong relationship between you make more money by putting less on, and therefore it's not a linear thing. You put 10% less fertilizer on and you get like 40% less leaching. You know, there's a lot of gains to be had because it's exponential worse for the environment once you get past that
so how can
biological stuff works like that.
It's not
because I think we tend to think of everything as having
linear,
a one-to-one linear relationship, but biology doesn't
there's
usually
lots of
trend like
curves
that.
And plateaus and things.
How can people like say if you're just shopping in the supermarket or maybe you've gone to your farmer's market or whatever, wherever people are at in terms of what they're prepared to do, how can people connect with what's going on in those farms in a way that they're feeling that their purchasing is supporting the farmers who are doing the right things?
Okay, well, I mean, I guess the easiest thing is organic, right?
Certified organic,
you can trust that. But, I mean, popping up all over the place. I mean, I've just been in Raglan for the last couple of days giving that talk there. And they've got a local milk supplier who supplies milk in bottles delivered to your letterbox, and it's a local farmer.
I remember
who farms.
That was my job when I was a kid.
Right, yeah,
Christchurch,
yeah,
put the milk
right.
bottles out.
Yeah, so I mean,
it's only recently gone away.
Yeah, but and then that's a local supplier that they all know, and he does, you know.
So
they,
locals are good
local,
because you know,
yeah. Well, I mean, we just can't. The reality is of Fonterra, of the brands that are in your supermarket, they're maybe 2% of Fonterra's production. I mean, we could all just refuse to buy Fonterra milk tomorrow, and I'm sure they wouldn't even notice it.
Wouldn't miss a beat.
No, they would just carry on because it's nothing. I mean, it's mostly export. A huge proportion of it goes as milk powder, as sort of some nameless commodity that ends up either replacing breast milk or, both, and going into additives into food products, mostly junk food, you know, bars, chocolate bars, and
salt and vinegar chips. Not allowed to eat them anymore because I went vegan recently and found out they've got bloody milk powder on them for the flavouring.
Is that right?
It was a real blow. Actually, there's some brands that are all right, but I've had to find them.
But I mean, that's what I mean. So, you know, I get really annoyed when I hear this, but we're feeding the world, we're feeding 40 million people. How is, you know, replacing breast milk feeding people? That's not feeding people, and neither is junk food. You know, we've got, you know, two of the nearly 7 billion people on the planet, about 2 billion are obese and overweight. You know, we've already got, and unhealthy because they eat crap food, you know, and at the other end's a billion that are undernourished. And so, you know, it's just false to claim that.
Yeah, it's not an issue. It's not an issue of the amount. It's a distribution.
Exactly. But I mean, it's quality as well.
We were talking about this when we did our greenwashing episode, how it can sort of be a company starting with the premise of I want to make some money, which is the usual place that people start, and then working backwards from there, going, well, how can I justify this? There's got to be some good way, good sort of spin, good outcomes, good aspects of what I'm doing, and it's easy. It's so easy to spin something about anything. It doesn't say much about where you're coming from, ultimately.
No, and there's very few people who have the, you know, the time and the ability to be able to critique what's going on either, you know. Really frustrating to hear on national radio this morning a discussion from the Enviromark people, which belong to the New Zealand government through Landcare, you know, talking about certification for companies for like carbon neutral and things like that. And just crazy. They just seem to get captured by the industry, because here was this person from Enviromark trying to you know, protect this idea that you know, for, say an oil company or Air New Zealand, and they say, oh, we're carbon neutral. What it means is that their, you know, their cars that they run around and in their little office is carbon neutral. Not that they're
not planes,
the same with oil companies. You know, their cars and their offices neutral because they, they use recycled paper or something. You know, these stupid little things like
that. Really, you can get to use that certification just by basically the office.
Yeah, that's what it's all about. It's just, you know, and they'll just ignore the really big thing,
the core business.
Yeah, it's just about how you run the business, not the business. You know,
right?
And this person from Enviromark defending
that's pretty freaking scammy, man. Like, I would never have thought that.
I know, but what if somebody says, "Okay, I'm an oil company, Mike's Oil, and I'm carbon neutral." Well, then you're surely going to go, "Oh, no way!"
I just assumed because I hadn't pay too much attention about what companies have it, but I assume they were offsetting somehow.
Yeah, no.
Like, or, I mean, you know, especially in New Zealand or something, I just assume they were planting.
Well, maybe we should have another discussion sometime about offsetting, and I'll talk to you about the reality.
It's a big, complicated.
Well, it's a big.
Just
think about it. There's the carbon cycle on the planet, the biological carbon cycle. Plants taking up carbon, and then they're being released when they break down, and when we eat them, and all that kind of stuff. All of that is biological turnover on the planet. We could replant every tree on the planet that ever was. We're never going to account for one, not ever was, but could be on the planet. We're never going to account for 1 kilogram of fossil carbon. All we're doing is replacing what we've chopped down. The fossil carbon was trees and the biological cycle that happened over millennia. Mm. So we're just completely kidding ourselves that trees are mitigating fossil fuels. They do not mitigate in any way fossil fuels. They take up carbon, but they're only taking carbon that was released from the cycle at the time. The whole thing's a scam, you know?
But Mike,
shit.
Damn. We've still got to, well, do we have to? I don't know. Mm. But it for me, I'm always coming back to, like, if we just unpack something like that and leave it there, then the end result is that people do nothing.
No, because, I mean, totally, trees are great. The more trees we have, the better.
Just to clarify.
So many reasons why we should have trees and why we should support growing trees and all that kind of thing. But I just don't kid yourself that you go for your holiday to Europe and plant some trees is going to in any way mitigate
you. You're still saying just fly less, people.
Well, yeah, that's right. We've got to stop that. You know, we don't kid yourself that we. I mean, this is the big myth that we think that we're going to carry on with life as it is at the moment, only we'll just do it with renewable, and that ain't going to work. You know, and mitigating through capturing it with trees. That's we need to get over that, because as long as we have that belief, we will just carry on doing what we're doing, you know. So we have to, you know, I feel that it's really important to knock that down and get people to understand the reality.
Thanks to our episode sponsor, Kokako Organic Coffee Roasters, whose team is steadfastly committed to their fair trade, organic and carbon neutral certifications, which not only allows us to trust that what they say is what they do, it also makes this cup of single origin Colombian coffee I'm sipping on taste that much more delicious. You can find them in the coffee grinder of some of the best cafes and restaurants across New Zealand. Or you can jump on their website to sign up for a subscription for home, shipped in a home compostable bag. Just go to kokako.co.nz.
Should we start talking about permaculture?
Yeah, I love permaculture.
I don't even know what it is. Who would like to have a run at explaining to me succinctly what a permaculture is?
Well, I mean, I just will start at the counter, which is the opposite, which is monoculture. And so, you know, back to Canterbury again, or Waikato, where it's just endless ryegrass paddocks. Oh, that's a monoculture with, you know, with cows on it. And there is, you know, whenever you have a monoculture, you have to use pesticides, you have to use fertilizers. You know, the natural system is naturally really diverse, and permaculture is, it's trying to imitate a really diverse ecosystem, where you have food at multiple levels. You have trees, you have, you know, ground, you have mid-range, and you recycle everything the way that nature recycles everything.
So you're saying that if we want to farm a crop without it getting diseased, there's kind of two options. One is to throw lots of petrochemicals at it, the herbicides, pesticides, because they'll knock everything back. And if you're not going to do that, then people are left, especially like, say, home gardeners, they're left going, oh, well, if I don't spray it, then they get all these diseases. And you're saying that permaculture is going, hey, there's another way, and that's imitating nature and having this diversity, because that's where the strength comes from in nature. You go into a native forest with its thousands of different types of things, and there's no diseases as such.
You don't need pesticides in a
exactly.
natural system.
You don't need a pesticide to work
through. So I mean, that's the answer. And it's like you said, well, not using not using petrochemicals, because we're not going to have that option very soon. So that's why you can see it as a choice now, and that's sort of basically what it comes down to. We choose, or we wait to catastrophe when we're forced to do it, you know, that way. So
at what scale does permaculture work? Is it how easy is it to do in the garden? How easy is it to do at a commercial dairy farming level?
Well, the thing with dairy farming doesn't fit with it, not like the way we do it at the moment. So we think of a farm being our dairy farm, right?
I guess that's a monoculture.
Yeah,
right,
that's
there,
a monoculture, exactly. So yeah.
But it could be an element of what people are doing.
And that's the way it traditionally would have been. The trouble with trying to convert from a system we have at the moment, we have, I think the average dairy farm is 150 hectares or something like that. I mean, it's a huge area and a massive investment in the dairy shed and all the infrastructure and that kind of thing. But a permaculture situation, you would have way, way less cows and all these other things going on the farm. But then when you think about that you can't, the trouble is, and I've had this so often with, talking to farmers in New Zealand, and it's natural that all they know is dairy farming, right? They grew up with it, their parents did it or whatever, or they've got into it, and that's what they know. You can't expect, some people are really good at doing multiple things, but generally, arborists are really good with trees, and beekeepers are really good with bees, and, there's specialists. And so what traditionally how it would have worked, and you can see examples of this still going in Eastern Europe, where a lot of the stuff is shared. So the beekeeper has hives over everybody's farms and shares it around, and then the butcher goes around all the farms and does the the butchering so it's about communities, and communities are crucial to these very diverse systems, as you have you have, you know, human communities that are diverse as well, and their knowledge to be able to run these things, you know.
So how, from, I get, it sounds utopian to me, like really beautiful.
Well, it is, it
but
is.
But are there examples of permacultures maybe around the world or even within New Zealand that are being successful at the moment? And does this seem to you, as someone who's studied this, and you're not an economist, but it seems like you're pretty well versed in the economics of these issues, how viable does this seem to be as a place for us all to start moving into on a large scale?
Well, I mean, the trouble is at the moment is that we subsidize the bad stuff. So when you talk about, you know, is it economical to do it? No, it's not. Because how can you compete with a system that's being subsidized to be allowed to pollute rivers? Then, you know, if we even the balance sheet and charge, you know, use true economics and charge those dairy farmers for their nitrate losses, then they wouldn't be dairy farming anymore, and then it would be viable. I think thinking of a bigger picture thing for New Zealand, though, is that the problem is that we only have, you know, is it getting close to 5 million people now? You know, a tiny proportion of New Zealand farmland could feed the 5 million people easily. You know, I mean, we're an export-led, or we're told we're export. It's actually about 3.5%, the dairy side of things, about 3.5% of our GDP is dairy. You know, even though they say the backbone.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's actually tiny. It's about $18 billion, which is just 3% or something.
3.5%, it's definitely not the picture that we're given. But
it's a
backbone thing.
We've all heard that.
Considering everything is a slice of the pie.
Yeah, yeah, then it's important. But then, okay, so we're going to be dependent on, you know, that the impacts of that, if it was paying its way. But so we have to, the whole world is going to want, those that can afford it, I'm thinking about, are thinking the same way around buy local, buy healthy. We don't want junk. You know, the world's is moving in that way. Okay, so we're on the other end of the world completely, dependent on fossil fuels to get our products out of
this
country.
Yeah, New Zealand's not buy local, is it?
So the other big part of our, you know, income is tourism, which is also completely dependent on fossil fuels and cheap flights and all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, you can see some major issues. So you can see on the plus side that when things get really tough, we're lucky and we've got rain, we've got water, we've got, you know, soils, we've got a lot of stuff going for us in that way. But when it comes to the big economic side of things, then we have to get our dependence off, you know, export-led. Yeah.
So to take your point that if we do take subsidies, which is sort of distorting the picture of how economically viable the current system is.
Yeah.
Do you, because I know there seems to be a lot of solutions in sustainability and in environmental awareness circles that are really good, but they sort of tap out when you scale them up to a certain point.
Yeah, yeah. No, well, I was going to say there are Canadian examples of, they call them closed loop farms, and they do have dairy in them, but what that means is they don't import any fertilizers. They run on themselves, kind of thing. They'll have lots of them have methane digesters, so they'll take the waste and turn it into gas to power machinery that they have on the farm, and that's really easy to do. Oh, they're just the waste material from animals,
right?
There's
like a suction cap on their butt.
So it all ends up in a vat basically, and anaerobically the methanogenic bacteria break it down and give off methane gas, and then you can. We had working examples here. Invermay Research ran the whole farm on biogas. That's the other term for it, is biogas. So you can get energy in that way, plus, you know, renewable energy. So you can have these things on a big scale. They have hydroponic vegetables, and, you know, they supply multiple markets and that. So there are working examples. I mean, the thing is that it's, you kind of, and this is where we're kind of, I'm on this environmental working group with Landcorp, and this is kind of the circle that we go around there. You can come up with much better ways of producing food. We looked at, for example, in Southland, where all that trouble is at the moment over the cows being up to their necks in mud, and we know about that issue for a long time. So we talked about, let's cut out the middle cow and make oat milk or wheat milk, because that's what the crop that was grown there up until dairy took over 20 years ago. And And that was great. You do the sums, way more protein per hectare, way more production, way more everything per hectare without the cows, way less water use. Fantastic, you know. But someone else has got to set up the plant and the infrastructure
right.
to make it, and the supplier can't
do that.
That
initial outlay
and,
is the problem.
And then, you know, that, well, just as a kind of a cautionary note here, what we did find is that the groundwater, the other thing you need to make good milk, of course, is clean water. And already the groundwater was at, had really dangerously high levels of nitrate in it just from that, you know, short time that intensive farming's been happening. So that kind of, you know, put the knocks on that a bit.
Do you
but, yeah, that's the thing.
Do you happen to know what New Zealand is? Are we trending away from dairy products at all in the, terms of our consumption?
Internally, no, I don't know, because it's such a tiny part of our production that I don't see the figures, you know. So, you know, I've seen a massive growth. I know that internationally the plant-based milks are growing faster than traditional
they're so competitively priced as well.
Yeah,
like you
yeah.
can get soy milk for the same or cheaper sometimes than,
yeah
than
but
dairy.
The trouble with cheaper is that generally it's cheaper because they're not paying the costs, you know. That's the trap that we fall into.
Still got to look for organic.
Yeah, well, I'm really
there's
worried.
A weird brand, and I'm hoping, I've got my fingers crossed that they're working at scale, which is why it's so cheap. And I forgot the name of the brand, but they've got organic certification,
right?
And they make a whole range of products which are really sort of well regarded as being pretty sustainably farmed. And they're like it's often $2.50 for a litre of soy milk from them at the supermarket. So I'm hoping it's that they've gotten efficient and they're doing it at scale. And that's
I mean, that's right. I mean, what we pay for milk is at that price because we're trying to compete with international markets, right? So there's a really good reason why I guess plant-based milk could be a lot cheaper. But I did want to have a word of warning here that you can get rid of cows, right? And I mean, a really good example was close to where I live on the Kapiti Coast near Wellington. There's a big vegetable growing area nearby called the sort of area of Horowhenua. And there are big intensive market gardens there where the leaching of nitrate is higher than dairy.
Wow.
So you can do anything badly. You industrialise anything.
Yep.
If any system relies on lots of outside stuff, then it will leak lots of stuff, you know.
On that note, what do you think the most important thing our listeners could do if they were going to do one thing? No, I don't mean like a particular tip. I'm meaning more a principle, like
the first one I would say would live by was have less animals or no animals in your food. You know, get the animals out of your food. I've got this great graphic that I use I'll be using in my talk tonight, but I don't know if you've heard it before, your listeners. If you take all of the mammals, start with the mammals on the planet, and you have, in one hand, you have all of the humans and all of the animals that provide food for humans and our domesticated pets and things, and the weight of them on the planet versus the weight of wild animals. And it's 98% us and what we eat, and 2% wild animals. So, you know, that's how much we dominate the planet. And that's why, you know, it's no surprise to me.
That is mind-blowing.
Isn't it?
You know, that we have...
It's kind of sickening too.
It feels
greedy and
it is.
Just sort of...
Well, it is, yeah. I mean, we don't see it, you know. We just no, I don't know, I'm going to say we, the royal we go to supermarkets and buy stuff and have no connection with the land or where it came from or anything like that. So that's how that can happen, is because people mostly aren't aware of it.
Yeah, like people, myself included, you hear about all the statistics about extinction particularly, and what you were saying before about the waterways, and it's so invisible. You can still look out the window and see the blue sky and the green grass or whatever, and then I was thinking, well, yeah, but how many types of insects or birds or trees even in New Zealand could I even name? Like, it'd be like maybe 20 or 30 or something, and we're talking about thousands and thousands of species that are threatened.
About 10,000.
And so it's like, no wonder we don't see it when we were actually only really conscious of about sort of maybe 20 to 30 species.
We were talking before we started the record about sort of different schools and education systems and stuff. It seems like to get a viable solution at the scale we needed and the sort of time we needed. Like, we need to change the curriculum at school and just educate an entire generation about how screwed we are and then sort of either fire them up to get angry like you are, Mike, or slightly despairing like I am, or hopeful like Waveney is. all roads leading hopefully to some large scale solutions on this.
I think that the thing is that that people need hope, and I don't like hope, I just mean
completely in black right now, everybody.
Well, you know, like, if you hope that you'll have some lunch tomorrow, it ain't gonna happen unless you go make some lunch tomorrow, you know. So that kind of blind hope is
hopeless. If you believed that there was absolutely no possible way that you could have lunch tomorrow, then you also wouldn't go out and make your lunch tomorrow.
So the thing is doing something, though. So doing something,
spoken like a scientist.
Well, yeah, go and get some bread or do some whatever you need to do to make your lunch tomorrow. And then as soon as you're doing something, then I don't think it's a despairing thing anymore.
I agree too.
So that's why I plead with people, or I say that our rent for living on this planet now is to be active, to be activists. We all have to be activists. Like, no matter, we all have our ways of doing it. We all have our specialities, and it might be tiny little things, it might be huge things, but we all have to do something, because just this kind of, you know, selfish looking after yourself and ignoring everything else and thinking that's all going to be all right has got us nowhere.
Yeah, I really liked what you said before about kind of scaling it up in our minds around what the problems are and what our response to that needs to be. And I think it's like, I mean, it is great to be able to keep it tangible and to look at taking your shopping bag and avoiding straws.
Yeah.
But it's also about acknowledging that we're on a journey and that the end destination might not be something that we can achieve tomorrow, but that we need to really focus on it and acknowledge. And it's, for a lot of people, it's just beginning that process of acknowledging that actually, holy shit, this is epic. This isn't just a few things on the side, but this is perhaps touching every aspect of my life. And not to sort of just pat yourself on the back until you've gotten there. And for me, it's about not beating myself up, about knowing that I've got a long way to go at all. It's just about feeling that I'm on a journey and that there is a long way to go, but that's okay.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I completely agree. And you can just get lost in despair if you don't do that. And my other warning is to beware of the weapons of mass distraction. And there's so many of them. And I see with kids the response of screens and gaming and stuff like that. They're zoning out, whether it's that or drugs, for many, many people, you know, as symptoms of a really screwed up situation we've got ourselves.
It's all escapism, isn't it?
Yeah, we're escaping it because it's so bad, and you know, that's
ironic. Gone.
Yeah,
so
it is.
Ironic.
It is, and you know, see the same result, the same kind of response from government, whether it's environmental or social. I mean, I was just so disappointed at this well-being budget, and you know, for example, I would put a whole lot of money into mental health. Well, you can keep throwing money at mental health until you've got no money, and you're not going to fix it, because you haven't fixed the problem. You know, you're just treating the symptom. And exactly the same with rivers. The other day they announced it was $12 million to clean up some rivers. What's the point if you know, because their idea of cleaning up is to kind of plant the banks or whatever, when you're ignoring the cause of the problem.
In summary?
Mostly it's intensification of farming or forestry, you know? And so it's dumb stuff that we do that has secondary effects on rivers, and thinking that you can go and clean it up in the same way that, you know, you're going to treat mental health while you're not, you know, doing anything about the cause, then you're just going to throw money away forever until we've got no more money, and then go, oh, well, hang on a minute, we didn't look at what the cause of this was, you know?
Well, a semi-hopeful note to end on, but I think a useful one.
As about as hopeful as you're going to get from me.
Absolutely, and it's important to be realistic, and that's why we appreciate you so much, both coming on the show and all the work that you do, Mike, communicating and advocating and being an activist in the most scientific sense of just go, hey, idiots, this is true. We've done the numbers. We've done the math. It is so needed in the world right now, especially, you know, we won't get into all the shit that's going on in America and alternative facts and this whole fake news BS that's going on. I think scientists are so important. We need to listen to our scientists. So thank you, Mike, for coming on the show.
Thank you.
And where can people find you and your work online to follow you around?
On Facebook, Dr. Mike Joy, and watercualitynz.info. Lots of information on there on that website.
Fantastic. And if you enjoyed this chat, please tell a friend, share it around, give us a review, give us some stars. That'd be great. We'll all spread the word and we will help save the world.
Awesome. Thanks, Mike.
Cheers.
If we have any chance of saving the world, we all need businesses to make changes. And fast. Contact GoWell Consulting to make sure your business is part of the better future. Go to gowellconsulting.co.nz to find an expert that will help your business navigate the journey.